guys. Okay, we are live in the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse at 67 East 11th Street in the landmark cast iron building in Greenwich Village, City of New York. It's my honor tonight to welcome Ted Reed, the author of Carl Furillo, published by McFarland. And Ted is a transportation reporter for thestreet.com, as many of you may know. And it's truly an honor to welcome Ted to the clubhouse this evening. We'll start tonight the way we always do. To those of you who are in the clubhouse for the first time, welcome. To those who have been here before, welcome home. I think what we'll do tonight is, since we have quite a few true Brooklyn Dodger fans in the audience, in addition to our usual baseball fanatics, and I'm sure some of you will have more questions than probably I would, we're going to get into a discussion with Ted. Ted will speak for a bit, and then we'll welcome questions. If we need to, we're going to have to say farewell to our podcast audience at some point, but we'll try to keep this going as long as Ted can stay. So I guess just to start, before you get going, just one question that I had is, I noticed that you dedicated the book to Carl Furillo with an apology. And I thought that was fascinating. And if you could just mention what, and if it's in your talk, that's fine. If not, what drew you to Carl Furillo? I think it just would be fascinating. And then Ted's going to get into really quite a bit, but the main two, the thrust of it, 1947, Jackie Robinson, and the lawsuit, as well as many other interesting facts about Carl Furillo.
I'd like to stand up if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to get to that very quickly about why I wrote this. Thank you very much for coming, everybody. I'm really happy about that. I'm glad there's so much interest in a baseball player whose career ended 52 years ago. I know that people in New York love Carl, and I also know that his full story has never really been told. Carl, unfortunately, got a bad rap early in his career for something he didn't do, and he left baseball on an unpleasant note, actually had to sue Major League Baseball. This was long before the players' organization was so strong, and he wasn't very successful as a result. These two unfortunate events that tarnished his career, and they changed the course of his career, and in particular, they changed the course of his life after baseball. It's really sad because if the same thing had happened 20, 30 years later, Carl Furillo never would have been considered a person outside of baseball. He would have easily stayed in for his whole life. In answer to your question, I started to work on this book over 40 years ago. That's why I had to apologize for the delay. I was a college student at Wesleyan, and I read a New York Times story about how Carl was working as an elevator installer at the World Trade Center and had been forced out of baseball. I thought that was worth writing my college thesis about, and it was then worth writing about, and it is now. I found that all of the regular members of that great Dodger lineup of the 50s, we all know them so well, but Carl was the only one who didn't have a book written about him. Even then, I somehow managed to get his phone number. I called him up. I went to meet with him a couple of times at his home in Flushing, a mile or so from the ballpark, and once at the World Trade Center. I wrote his autobiography as my senior thesis, and I graduated from college as a result. Over the years, I tried to get this book published, and finally, a few years ago, I got in touch with McFarland Publishing, which is based in Jefferson, North Carolina, near where I live in Charlotte. They said they were interested if I rewrote it, and that took me about a year working on weekends. The book came out last year. I guess the first thing people think about when they think of Carl Furillo is his arm. He is considered one of the greatest right fielders in baseball history because of it. Even today, more than 50 years after his last game, Carl is on the list whenever people talk about the greatest right fielders who ever lived. At his funeral, Carl Erskine talked about how Furillo could throw guys out at first base.
Hi, Bob.
His lifetime stats are that he hit .2994, one hit away from 300. He had 1,910 hits, 192 home runs, and 1,058 RBIs. Those aren't Hall of Fame stats by any means, but they are pretty good stats. And what if you're also one of the greatest right fielders who ever lived? Isn't that enough to get in the Hall of Fame? Or does something more require than to be one of the greatest at your position? But it was either a curse or a blessing that Carl was on one of the greatest teams in baseball history, the Dodgers of the 1950s. Unfortunately, he was overshadowed by Robinson and Campanella and Hodges and Snyder and Reese. At the same time, the good side, being on this team, Carl got to play in 7 World Series, and he starred in some of them. This Brooklyn Dodgers team was in more than its share of the greatest baseball games ever played. There was a Bobby Thompson home run in 51, Don Larson's perfect game, the 7th game of the 55 World Series when they finally beat the Yankees, when Sandy Amoros made the catch of Yogi Berra. You could even add the last game of the 1950 season as one of their greatest games ever played. A Dodger win would have led to a playoff, but they lost in 10 innings to the Phillies, who went to the series. That was the Whiz Kids. Robin Roberts was 21. They lost in 4 straight, 3 one-run games. So at this time, baseball was our most important form of entertainment. It's hard to imagine now, but baseball and movies were the most important things that people had to fill the pastime, and the Dodgers are right in the middle of it. In 1946, the Americans came home from World War II. In 1947, Robinson joined the Dodgers. In 1955, the Dodgers finally beat the Yankees after 5 attempts. And then, just 2 years later, the Brooklyn Dodgers died. They played in Los Angeles in 58. So that was a second great societal trend mirrored in the story of this one baseball team, the move of American society from the Northeast and the Midwest to California and then to the South. The Brooklyn Dodgers, in that time period, were a microcosm of everything that happened in our country in one of our most important periods in our history. So Carl Furillo was a part of all this, but sometimes not in the best way. In fact, you have to say that Carl got on the wrong side of history, and that's what diminished his image. You know, the matter of Jackie Robinson is really the most fascinating story. It's probably not fascinating enough to take up all of Citi Field, but still a fascinating story. This is a major event not just in the history of baseball, but also in the history of our country. Jackie Robinson was probably one of the 2 most important leaders of the Civil Rights Movement, him and Martin Luther King. It took a big toll on Robinson. He died at 53. His story has been told many times, of course, and he is probably the most honored baseball player who ever lived. But Carl Furillo, unfortunately, is thought of as someone who is opposed to Robinson's joining the Dodgers. Obviously not the best image to have. Also, totally untrue. I want to talk for a while about how this perception came to be. Carl himself told me this story the first time I interviewed him. When Robinson came to spring training in 1947, the Dodgers didn't want to train in the South, so they trained in the Caribbean. Part of the time, they were down in Panama, and the players stayed in an old Navy barracks in Panama. We had troops in Panama in World War II, so the Japanese wouldn't come into South America. They were successful, our troops. Carl then was 26, basically a kid, just back from the war in the Pacific. He was lying on a cot. The Southern ball players, Dixie Walker, Bobby Bragan, Pee Wee Reese, Kirby Higbee, maybe some others, they were talking about getting up a petition against letting Robinson play with the Dodgers. Someone noticed Carl and said to him, "What would you do if Robinson tried to take your job?" And Carl said, "I'd cut his effing legs off." Carl said he shouldn't have said that. It led to an impression that he was opposed. Seems that Branch Rickey, the Dodger general manager, had a conversation with him about it. Some of the Southern players said they did not want to play with Robinson. Carl never said that. Within a month, Robinson was accepted on the team, and from all indications, he had a very good relationship with Carl. At one point, in one of the newspaper clips I have, Robinson even talked about how he felt he became a member of the team when he became able to talk to Carl and some of the other veteran players, some of the other important players on the team. In 1955, after the Dodgers won, Carl actually kissed Robinson and his wife at the celebration at the Hotel Bossert after the game. That's not what history has seen. What history has seen is a movie, the Jackie Robinson story. You can buy it for $5 now. It's a pretty bad movie, but Jackie Robinson himself is in it, so it's certainly worth seeing. But in that movie, an Italian ball player is opposed to Robinson. And Rickey has to talk to that ball player and give a speech about how nobody said your father could not work and should go back to Italy. And this is a case where the movie became reality. Carl Jr. told me his dad was furious when he watched it. It's no wonder he was furious. One thing I came across in my research was an article in the Sporting News where Harold Parrott, a former newspaper reporter who worked for the Dodgers, wrote a story that took a similar view of Carl. I'm going to read part of this. It involves the petition against Robinson that I just mentioned. I did a lot of research on this for my book because that petition is talked about so much. Nobody really knows if there was a petition or not. Bobby Bregan, who was from Alabama and who was in the middle of the opposition to Robinson, has said repeatedly in interviews that no petition existed. I personally don't think there was one. But even if one existed, not a single person has ever suggested that Carfarillo signed it. Not a single person other than Harold Parrott. And this is what he wrote, what Harold Parrott wrote. He writes, quote, "Some of the Southern gentlemen had framed a petition demanding that Ricky dismiss the controversial black for the good of the team. Now the thing was all ready, complete with ballpoint pen. But who would take it around to get it signed? They knew whoever did this would be about as popular with Ricky as Judas Iscariot. The author of the document handed it to Farillo and suddenly fell ill, taking the day off so he wouldn't be suspected. Farillo, son of a simple Sicilian immigrant, was as out of place pushing an anti-Negro petition as he would have been unraveling calculus. Ricky had him on the carpet now. Farillo, the old man boomed. How long ago did your father come over on the boat? The outfielder was bewildered. His lips moved and he counted on his fingers. Finally he announced, 35 years about. Said Ricky. Now just suppose, and I want you to think seriously about this, Carl. Before you answer, just suppose that 35 years ago a few idiots got together and made up a petition to send him back to Sicily, and they got another idiot to take it around Reading, or wherever your father was living. Suppose all that had happened and your father went back. Now I want you to think before you answer, Carl. My question is, where would you be today? Farillo blinked. Finally, he said, I never thought of that, Mr. Ricky. End of petition, but not the end of Robinson's trials, not by a long shot. Well, that's clearly insulting. It's just so demeaning to write about someone like that. And also, it's obviously wrong on at least three counts. First, Carl's parents were not from Sicily. They were from Naples. Secondly, Carl did not speak with a Brooklyn accent. He never even came to Brooklyn until he played for the Dodgers and played his first game. And as I said, he never signed any petition. So this was all untrue, and this was the image that was created of Carfarillo in there, that people held, and that was in the movie. Do you want to know what was going on here? It was all the myth-making around Branch Rickey. Rickey had a group of people around him who wanted to glorify him. There's nothing unique about that. All important people have these circles of yes people around them. But, you know, when the owners voted early in 1947 whether to let Robinson play, the vote was 15 to 1 against. The commissioner of baseball, Happy Chandler, decided to overrule the owners. You know what happened after that? Branch Rickey got some of the best baseball players ever, Robinson, Campanella, Newcomb, to be on his team, which remained a successful team for a decade and beyond. But Happy Chandler got fired for going against his bosses. Not to say that Ricky is not a hero, but isn't Chandler a hero too? Yet in his book, Chandler says the people around Ricky never wanted to give him any credit. In the same way, they were happy to use Carfarillo as an Italian fall guy to make Ricky look better. In a way, that isolated Carl on the team, and I write about that a lot. The other thing I want to talk about, the other bad incident in Carl's life, is the way that he left the Dodgers. In 1959, it was just the second year in Los Angeles, the Dodgers won the World Series. Carl was 38, an old ball player, one of the oldest in the league. But he won a game in the playoffs with a pinch hit, and then he won a World Series game with a pinch hit. Obviously, this guy could still hit, but his legs were shot. Too bad they didn't have a DH then. It would have been perfect for Carl. And the next year, early in the 1960 season, the Dodgers released Carl after he played in 8 games, but he was injured. The communication was not good between Carl and Buzzy Bavese, the general manager. Bavese did not release him in a face-to-face meeting. He released him on a Thursday. He told him on the phone, and then he went to San Francisco to play a series with when the Dodgers played a series with the Giants. The reporters came to Carfarillo's house. Carl said, quote, "They have to pay me for the full season because I'm injured." Somebody told him he should hire a lawyer. One thing led to another. Harsh words were exchanged in the newspapers. Carl and Bavese, they both lost their tempers. By the time they met, they could barely speak to one another, and there were lawyers involved by then, and just anger was expressed at their meeting afterwards, and they yelled at each other, and Carl walked off kind of distraught. Then he had his lawyer. He sued baseball to get the season salary he felt he had coming to him because he felt he should be paid for the full season. The Dodgers basically agreed to settle. They were going to pay him. Their whole philosophy really was to take care of these ball players. They had done the same thing for Carl Erskine the season before, kept him on the roster after he couldn't play anymore. But this collapsed in the harsh words and misunderstanding between Carl and Bavese. So Carl had a hearing in the commissioner's office here in New York, but it was basically just theater. The commissioner ruled against Carl, but the Dodgers had already agreed to pay him. Carl also tried to get paid for a second season, saying he was still injured, which he was, but that was an unprecedented argument, and even his own lawyer did not really back him up on that. After that, after suing baseball, Carfarillo was out of baseball. He wrote to every team, but he couldn't get a job. He charged that he was blacklisted. There were 16 teams. He had written to everyone. I was really sad because in 1969, Carl was living in Flushing, and his old roommate, Gil Hodges, was manager of the Mets, and they won the World Series. Carl should have been the third base coach on the Mets. That would have been good for baseball, good for Carl, good for the Mets, and good for the Mets fans, and good for New York. But it didn't happen, which I think is really a shame. I have a little bit I want to read about that, because this story actually came out to a happy ending. But just something about Carl during that period when he was very unhappy and he wanted to get back in baseball. And he lived in Flushing. And, you know, in 1969, this was all baseball here. As for baseball, Farrillo had not given up his hopes of getting back into the game. Carl Farrillo Jr. recalls that during Wes Westrum's tenure as manager of the Mets, from 65 to 67, his father and Westrum would occasionally talk. At one point, quote, "Wes called Dad to talk about Ron Swoboda, some problem he was having. Dad tried to give him some insight, and Wes said, 'Hey, if I could get you a job as hitting and fielding coach, would you accept it?' And Dad said, 'Yeah.' So Wes said, 'I'll get back to you.' But 2 weeks later, he called and said the front office told him no. He didn't give a reason. It was too bad, because my dad still loved baseball. That was his heart and soul." It was at this time that Roger Kahn interviewed Carl and was working on that book, Voice of Summer, and in that book, Carl is portrayed as someone very angry at baseball, which at the time he was. But the story kind of has a happy ending, partially happy ending, because in the early 70s, Peter O'Malley, owner of the Dodgers, reached out to Carl, invited him to play in an old-timers game. Peter's dad had owned the team when they were in Brooklyn, and Peter owned the team in Los Angeles. Peter invited Carl to several Dodger events, and Carl was a coach for several seasons in Dodger fantasy camps in Florida. So he began to reconcile with the Dodgers in his latter years, which made him happy. Carl died relatively young. He was only 66. In 1989, Peter O'Malley came to Carl's funeral. In fact, I was told he even offered to pay for the funeral, and Mrs. Farrillo turned him down. But he said very nice things, and he said that the Dodgers made a mistake and should have handled the whole thing differently. It was a nice thing to do. As Carl Jr. told me, it was a little late, but it was a wonderful thing to do. I just want to talk about one more thing, and then I'd like to answer questions. But one thing that really had a good time in writing this book was I got to be very close to Carl Jr., who's my age, and I never met him except for when I was interviewing his dad 40 years ago. So when I talked to him on the phone, he sounded very much like his dad, and I had the impression that I was actually talking to Carl when I was working on the book, and it, as questions came up, it was as if I had the opportunity to run them by Carl. I also had access to a scrapbook, which a fan kept for years and then gave it to Carl Ferrillo. This fan had taken all the newspaper clips throughout Carl's career, even dating back to when Carl played the 1942 season in Montreal. I just want to read one of these clips because I really felt it took me, put me in touch with a period in our history when this was before World War II, and somebody had actually found these clips from Montreal. Most of the clips were from the Reading newspapers. That's where Carl lived, and they had two newspapers, and somebody just collected every story written about Carl for 10 years. In May, the Montreal Star wrote about Ferrillo's appeal under the headline, "Ferrillo, quite a fellow," Royals fandom finds. The story noted that Carl is a common subject among the fans nowadays, as he seems to improve day by day almost every time out. Clyde Sukforth, the manager and one of the people close to Ricky, described Ferrillo this way. "He's a wonderful type, got a great temperament. He doesn't even know who's pitching out there. He doesn't care or possibly doesn't know who we're playing, but he's in the ball game every part of it." And then, this is a quote from Carl about those days. "All in all, those were the years I really loved," Ferrillo said. "I was single at the time and I was making a fairly good dollar, $300 a month. And the money was secondary. The game was more important than the whole thing." It quickly became apparent that Carl was a major league prospect. But that was 1942. At the end of the season, Carl was thinking that he'd be able to go to the Dodgers the following year. And instead, as the Reading newspapers reported, one day he was called up and he spent 4 years in the South Pacific. He turned down a Purple Heart. He thought he wasn't worthy because he'd seen so many people die. And when America came back and when Carl came back, it was 1946. So, love to answer questions.
In the book, it seems like Carl has sort of a chip on his shoulder. He's almost getting mad at Ricky when they're doing the contract negotiation, but it sounded from your descriptions of it that he would always felt like he was being picked on, or that he would get angry easily and feel that he was being treated unfairly. Do you think that in part played into this image of him as a bad guy?
Yes, Carl was not perfect and did kind of have a chip on his shoulder. He had a working class sensibility towards his bosses and resented some of them, but not Ricky. You know, Ricky said the toughest ball player I ever negotiated a contract with was Carl Ferrillo, but they had a great level of mutual respect, and Ricky's son said that he liked to negotiate with Carl because Carl knew what he wanted and was able to argue for it, and Carl liked Branch Rickey a lot because he said Branch Rickey always kept his word, always honored his contracts. He didn't feel like that later on. And also, when Carl left in Los Angeles, there was an article written that he didn't get along with his managers, but in fact, he got along very well with both Shotten and with Charlie Dressen. So he did get along with a lot of the people that he worked for. He didn't get along with DeRocher. With who? DeRocher?
Right.
Yeah, DeRocher and Alston, they were kind of cold towards one another also. But yeah, he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. I think that was healthy, though. Yes, sir.
I hated DeRocher.
DeRocher threw at him. DeRocher had pitchers throw at him. But even before then, when he came up, when DeRocher was his manager, when he came up, and they didn't get along from the get-go.
What
were
some of the salaries between 47 and 57?
Carl's final salary was $33,000. That was in 59, $33,000. When he started, he had to sign for the major league minimum, which had just been adjusted upward after the war, and that was $5,000. So his salary gradually went up from $5,000 to $33,000 during those years.
How does his starting salary, I think, was $35,000?
3,500? His starting salary?
What? His starting salary, what did he say?
Robbins. What was Robbins' salary?
Oh, that I do not know.
Well, it was 3,500, yeah. Well, it was 3,500 in Montreal, probably 5,000, 6,000, the major league minimum, 47.
Yeah, so I guess in Montreal it was lower, and Carl had the same debate. And Carl had the same debate because he went into spring training with Montreal, so he was at 3,500 also. And then, I mean, Carl's chip on his shoulder was when he was first showed itself when he tried to get 5,000 because he was promoted to the Dodgers.
Another thing, he used to protect the right field wall so people who wouldn't get a suit from Abe's stock, right?
That's right. Hit sign, win suit.
Did he get something back for that?
One time he won the suit, but, you know, as far as playing right field, he would go out there and practice till his hands were bloody. I had Clint Levine talking about that. Yes, sir.
I had the opportunity to talk to Gene Hernandez about the
salaries. Talk a little bit louder. A little louder.
A little louder. I was talking to Gene Hermansky, the guy who succeeded Pete Meester at center field, the Dodgers. He played there for about 8 years. He was in a 6 or 7 World Series. Not a few, but a bit. Talking about how salaries have changed in baseball. He said, take a guess as to how much I was paid at the maximum for the Dodgers at that. I said, I don't know. Reg Rickey had the El Cheapo designation from the local press. And so I started low. It was $25,000. $20,000. He said, my top salary was $18,500. He said, they reported that I was making $20,000. And when they asked for where's the other $1,500,
well, Hermansky was a pretty good ball player, but Branch Rickey was a tough guy to negotiate with, and we'll ask Lee, who wrote a book about Branch Rickey.
Well, Hermansky had this great line about Mr. Rickey had a heart of gold, and he kept it. But, you know, that there are a couple of things about, well, we're never going to know that whole petition story. But it's interesting, when you were talking to Paul Ferrillo Jr., and he mentioned Reese as one of the people who was, Reese was quoted when Robinson came up, and they thought he was a second baseman, and Reese said, well, as long as he's not a shortstop. And so, I personally don't think there was a petition either, but there was a lot of stuff happening, and I don't understand how the Ferrillo story got into parody and then into Man in the movie. There was absolutely no truth to the story. I mean, we'll never know. But
I think, you know, there were people around Rickey who wanted to make Rickey look better.
Well, no. You see, that's where I disagree with you. Rickey had nothing to do with it.
No, Rickey had nothing to do with it.
He had nothing to do with the movie.
I agree, right.
And Arthur Mann wanted to play him in the movie. And for once, Rickey put his foot down and says, no, we're going to get... And Minor Watson did a pretty good job. I don't know if we'll ever know how he got linked to this. Because, you know, Mann and Parrott did try to create that story that backfired on DeRocher and McPhail and the betting and gamblers in 47. That's clear, but I just don't understand why they would put this out if there wasn't a tiny bit of truth to it.
Well, but the tiny bit of truth was that he said that thing in Panama.
Yeah.
Made a remark. He did talk. Probably Robbie Bragan told me that he talked to Rick. That Ricky talked to several players, including Carl. And so that was all it took. And then the movie came out after the 47 season.
No, the movie didn't come out till 1950. The movie was supposed to come out in 1948, but it didn't.
So
you know, this is really, it's a fascinating bit of historiography, you know. And the new movie on Robinson is now, the Harold Parrott book is being used. The Lords of Baseball, I don't think, which he wrote in 74, recreates that Ferrillo story, you know. I hope not.
I hope it's not recreated in the movie. There's a new movie coming out about Branch Rickey, and the great fear is that it'll recreate this book about Carl Furillo, but I don't know how to reach anyone working in the movie.
I think it's General Mitchell tells the story of Carl Furillo.
Yeah.
I think it's General Mitchell tells the story of Rickey and Al Schreiner.
All right.
Well, no. I mean, we all know that Rickey was frugal with the dollar.
And
Kiner, we had Kiner in Pittsburgh, and Kiner hit 40 home runs or 50, and he said, "Well, you can finish last with you, we can finish last without." Which they did.
Yeah, Rickey was tight, but Rickey had the heroic qualities, of course, to bring them up. Yes, great.
How did you do your research for the book other than speaking to Carl Jr.? Did you go up to Cooperstown? I mean, how hard was it to find out about Carl Furillo?
Let's see. Well, I started with this book that I've written on him, so that made it pretty easy. A lot of baseball stuff on the internet. I did a lot of interviews, particularly Carl Erskine was sort of my go-to guy because he remembers he's 80 and remembers everything, must have written me 100 emails. The Sporting News is online if you're in Sabre, so I got to read all the Sporting News clips. And, of course, I also had this scrapbook with clips for pretty much most of Carl's career, day by day, from the two Reading newspapers. So I was fortunate to have a lot of material, and including, you know, having had the opportunity to go through it all with Carl himself in an interview. Yes, sir.
What specifically did you come across between Furillo's interactions with Hodges while at the time Hodges was in New York? Did you get anything from Carl or anyone else about whatever type of
interaction? Well, that's an interesting question. I think I'll tell this story. So they were pretty good friends. There's a picture of them together with their kids. They would fish together. Hodges, of course, was in that slump. And he went to Carl, and he talked to his roommate, of course. And his roommate, and Carl told me he would stay up all night smoking cigarettes and fingering a cross that he wore. So I decided to expand my awareness a little bit, and I called up I got Joan Hodges' phone number and called her up. And she begged me not to use the part about Gil fingering the cross, so I took it out. I don't know if I should have taken it out, but I did. So they were quite close. However, during the entire time that Gil was manager of the Mets, he never called Carl. Yes, sir.
Did they pay any Capsule more money after the Mets took over for the Mets Gil upfield?
Paco took over, but I don't know if he was paid. I don't know if he was paid more. Although it was said by some people that was the greatest outfield ever assembled: Furillo, Snyder, Paco. But then when O'Malley came, they wanted to save money and they got rid of Paco and never replaced him. I mean, really, that was really a tragedy. So, I mean, Rickey wanted to pinch pennies, but really O'Malley wanted to pinch pennies even more. So why didn't the Dodgers win a few more times with this great lineup? Because they didn't fill the gaps. And they got rid of Paco.
But I don't think they won the pennant with Paco, right? If I remember correctly, he didn't hit that as well as they thought he would hit. But he was a fantastic, ball player. I don't know if you don't know what he
I can't play. Recall the years that Paco was there.
Well, he was there in 51.
Yeah, he must have been there in 52. And then he went to the Braves. I think he went to the Braves. Yeah.
In 53 to the Braves?
He came from the Cubs. So
yeah. He came from the Cubs, right. That's when Hermansky was traded.
Yeah.
Recall the years that Paco was there.
How did the arm develop? Did he pitch?
He was a pitcher. He started out as a pitcher when he was playing as a kid in Reading. He started out as a pitcher, but he was a little bit wild. And so one of these early guys in Reading in like youth baseball moved him to the outfield. And one of the writers in Reading had gone to high school with Carl, junior high with Carl. And they recall that he was a pitcher, but that ended quickly because he was a little bit wild.
Didn't he hit an umpire with your jaw with a throw from right field? He was throwing it to third, second base umpire had his head turned.
Recall that story. Could be true.
How true is the account that the game against the Dutch League Giants, and Rocha asked his pitcher to hit Furillo? Furillo, I think, went up to first base, but then eventually ended up in the dugout, choking Rocha, and ultimately having Monty Thurman step on his hand and break it or something. Did anybody hear it?
Carl felt that DeRocher twisted his finger in order to get him out of the lineup. Carl felt that that was all that was DeRocher's doing, not Monty Irvin's doing. Carl said that all the ballplayers in the Giants hated DeRocher just like all the ballplayers in the Dodgers had.
Yeah, they told him to keep, you know, don't stop.
So he did it.
Kill him. He said, I wasn't afraid to go in the dugout because I knew the players wouldn't stop trying to stop me. And he felt that DeRocher twisted his finger because he was leading the league and hitting at the time.
He won a batting championship.
Yep, he still won the batting championship.
Harry Walker, Dixie Walker's brother, by a percentage point.
So, you know, they say Hodges should be in the Hall of Fame and Ferrillo should be in the Hall of Fame, but Hodges never led the league in anything. And Ferrillo once led the league in hitting. And they were equally good fielders. To be kind to Hodges, they were equally good fielders.
I'm sure Hodges had a lot more homers than.
Yes, he was more power hitter.
And I think he was
Much lower. He was a 250 hitter. But he also got credit for managing the Mets as well as he should have. But if Carl hadn't been blacklisted, he might have been associated with those Mets also.
Mentioned John Hodges. She told me, she was told by the Hall of Fame people that they already had too many Dodgers from that team in the Hall of Fame. So he almost got it.
I think that
they're still voting
true.
Him out. They're still voting him out.
Right. Yes, yeah, just last year they felt he might have a chance. And that also, of course, hurt Carl.
Life.
Yes, and she's helped Carl. I mean, she's helped Gil, you know, kept the campaign alive. And personally, I feel they should both be in. But obviously, you can see what you just said is probably true.
But, you know, I mean, Carl Ferrillo was a very, very good ball player. But you can make the argument, if he gets involved, if he was a Hall of Fame, think about all the other, you know, maybe hundreds of other guys.
Hundreds of other guys mentioned as the greatest right fielder who ever lived. I mean, there's probably
three
or
good,
four.
Who was good baseball players as Carl Ferrillo. And I'm a diehard Dodger fan, but
well, but if you're
lowering the bar, so.
But you got to factor in the defensive area also, right? Which is hard to measure because when you say he's the greatest right fielder who ever lived, that's not really talking about his offense. That's talking about his defensive play, and I think that's what qualifies him.
Bill Mazeroski got
in. The best. I mean, that's what you're talking about. Too many guys in there.
That was good enough.
The voting system's flawed, I feel, anyway. I mean, because, you know, you have a lot of writers who have a very narrow-minded view of, like, I heard one person saying he's never going to vote for anybody from the steroid era, and it's like, so you're not going to vote for Derek Jeter. And in terms of defensive statistics, there's really no perfect measure.
Right,
ever.
That can't be measured.
And it's really all what you saw.
Yes.
That's
that's a problem. That's a problem, and plus the problem that, you know, there are too many Dodgers in there.
That's a ridiculous argument because if somebody's a Hall of Famer, they're a Hall of Famer. And, like, I don't agree with the whole first ballot Hall of Famer. Vote somebody, you know, somebody's a Hall of Famer from the get-go. I understand, like, over the course of several years, more writers come around to it, but still, like, you know, if somebody's a Hall of Famer, they're a Hall of Famer.
Yes, sir.
Do you ever think of retiring as number of the Dodgers?
Yeah, I thought that.
Not that I know of. Right after he left, Ron Fairley took his number. I have a chapter about Ron Fairley because Carl mentored Ron Fairley, and as a sign of respect for Carl, Ron Fairley asked for his number. Initially, Carl was offended by that, but then Sandy Koufax called and said, Carl, he took it as a sign of respect to you, and so he wasn't offended.
So there's still a chance that they could retire?
I guess if they, I mean, if they decided to, but you know, Carl Ferrillo's memory is diminishing, not growing.
There used to be a radio show with the Doris Day that was DeRocher's wife and Leo DeRocher.
Lorraine Day. Doris Day with Maury Wills.
Yes, and one time Carl refused to be on her show because she was DeRocher's wife.
He did?
Yeah.
Well, they gave Jackie Robinson a very hard time on that show.
Oh, isn't that?
No, if I remember correctly, there was a big problem with that. With Jackie Robinson and Lorraine Day on the show.
It
was the opposite. Maybe Jackie Robinson had a show and Lorraine Day on the show.
There was an opposite.
Well, DeRosa had a lot of conflict with a lot of people, but particularly with Carl.
Did Carl go on Happy Feldman?
Yes. Yeah. The guy who was at the, who was last time who came to the, when I talked to the Brooklyn Historical Society, recalled seeing him. And I was also on, was a kid then, and was on the, became a lifelong Carrillo fan because he was on the Happy Feldman show when Carl came and got to ask Carl a question. But, you know, most of the Dodgers were on that show repeatedly.
Why would he know?
Yeah.
Well, if he was sour,
Oh, yeah, but yeah, right, but he wasn't really sour, yeah.
What did Carl Ernstine, because he's such a fair-minded, objective, what were his recollections of Fudo?
He was considered himself, he considered Carl to be one of his best friends. He looked very favorably on him. He didn't really have any harsh words to say about Carl. Carl Erskine did see both sides of the conflict with the Dodgers at the end, because the year before in 59 or 58, the Dodgers had been very kind to Erskine. When it was time for him to leave, they brought him back to give him enough years in the majors. They gave him a chance, Bovesi gave him a chance to stay on the team or to go to the minors, pretty much gave him a choice, made sure he got paid. And so he had seen the good side of the Dodgers, and he just felt, as we probably all agree, you know, these two guys lost their temper and led to a point that neither one wanted to be at. And as far as the Robinson case, he never heard Carl say anything bad about Robinson. He saw them getting along well, and he didn't believe any of the negative stuff about Carl and Jackie.
Was Carl and
his
boys
a
summer Roger Kahn?
Yes, he was. At the time that Roger Kahn interviewed him, he was in a phase where he was, which was the same time I interviewed him, he was very negative about baseball. And Roger Kahn portrayed that to the such an extent that the Ferrillo family wasn't very happy with the book. Kind of overdid it.
Any other questions? All right, well, I would like to thank our audience of baseball and Dodger fanatics, as well as Ted Reed, the author of Carl Ferrillo, Brooklyn Dodgers All-Star. Thank you so much, Ted.